here on WNHH, your home for community radio in New Haven, broadcast at 103.5 FM, live streamed at newhavenindependent.org, broadcast from our offices here on Elm Street in New Haven. I'm your host, Paul Bass, inviting you to look behind the headlines on the stories that make New Haven tick. Now, believe it or not, some people in our state are already thinking about an election for governor, an election that doesn't take place until the fall of 2018. And more people are thinking about it since Governor Daniel P. Malloy last week announced that he will not seek a third four-year term. Now, the man in our studio today, Dan Drew, was already gearing up for a 2018 run for governor. He got in before the going got good, similar to the way Bill Clinton got in 1992 before everybody else realized that George Bush didn't have the approval ratings they thought he had. So Dan Drew jumped in before Malloy made that announcement. He's here in the WNHA studio today telling us why he'd like to run our state. And thanks to Yale New Haven Hospital for providing support for today's program. Dan Drew, welcome to WNHH in New Haven.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here with you and your listeners.
How are things? Now you're the mayor of Middletown. How are things up in Middletown?
They're going great. We have a AAA bond rating. Our unemployment rate's cut in half. We have a lot of economic development going on. Everything's hooking along nicely.
Great college town. I always feel like it's the little New Haven.
There's a lot of similarities. So there's a good vibe in both places.
Used to have Mamoons, but no longer.
Yep.
Now, is It's Only Natural really out of business? Someone told me the other day. Why did someone thought it went out of business? I know they moved onto Main Street and they kind of upgraded. That's the vegetarian restaurant.
Yeah, they're doing
that
great.
That is the magnet for people like me to hit Middletown.
They're right up there in the North End. They're going strong. I just walked by there the other night and it was packed.
It's across the street from a long-standing music place. What's that called?
Which music place are you referring to?
They have bands there. It's a bar.
Oh, the Buttonwood.
Buttonwood, yeah. Cafe. That's up there. And then up down the street, you had an expansion of your natural foods market that was related to It's Only Natural,
correct,
right?
It's actually got the same name.
And it's got a, but it's across the street. It's got a whole parking lot now and all that kind of stuff.
Got a whole parking lot. You can get all kinds of organic food. They're both right next to the fire department. We've got police
along your
the
Main
beat.
Street. It's getting a kind of, it's got a, I always found Middletown Main Street. I feel it's got old and new kind of mixed together. And one theory was that, did you guys have less urban renewal in the 60s and 50s than New Haven had? So some of the older buildings downtown stayed up longer?
There was quite a bit of urban renewal. And that's part of how the downtown and the riverfront got separated when Route 9 was built. And there was a whole section of old buildings that got wiped out.
Okay. So it's just that stretch that got preserved sort of where It's Only Natural is. Because I know it's just sort of like cigar stores and stuff like that next to an older fashion, even some kind of dry goods type stores that you'd see in the old days next to this, the modern kind of yuppie college town stuff you see. Right?
That's true. There's an eclectic mix of both. And it's kind of neat because some of the architecture is a lot older and it really mixes in nicely with some of the new things being built.
So there were a few blocks that were spared by urban renewal.
Yes.
And those are sort of right in the center of town.
Correct.
And then you got Wesleyan University right near the edge of downtown, correct? And that helps fuel the downtown commerce.
That's right. It's up on the hill. We have a lot of students coming downtown and we just worked with the university and the Chamber of Commerce and RJ Julia Bookstore to bring the bookstore downtown. So RJ Julia is opening a new location in downtown Middletown that's also going to double as the Wesleyan Bookstore.
Hey, I didn't know that. Because here in New Haven, Yale partnered with a big chain, the Barnes & Noble. But RJ Julia's branched out.
Yeah, and it's nice for us to have a locally owned chain with a great local reputation. And the restaurant Grown, which is another organically sourced food store, is going to be going in there as the cafe. So it's really going to be exploding in that
section. What happened to that mini mall where It's Only Natural used to sit? Is it still filled up?
Or? It's still there. It's filled up. There's retail in there. There are some insurance companies. There's all kinds of stuff in there.
And has Wesleyan grown?
Wesleyan is doing really well. Their admissions rate is very, very competitive. So I think their student population is growing, and they're doing a lot of things with us, and we have a good collaborative relationship with them right now.
Cities like New Haven, Middletown have benefited from growth of universities when older-style manufacturing has gone away from cities in the last half century. How has Middletown rolled with that? Does Middletown still have a blue-collar base? What's the economic makeup of your city?
We do. We have a very broad economic makeup. We work very closely with Wesleyan, and we've partnered with Wesleyan on a number of economic initiatives, but we've also focused on our transportation and logistics sector. We have a very strong representation in the trades, and so we try to hit all of those areas and make sure that all of those areas are going strongly in Middletown. And it's one of the reasons I think that we're doing really well. We have a diversified economic base in our town, and we focus on everybody's needs.
Who's the big employer?
Middlesex Hospital is a big one. Pratt & Whitney is a very big one. Wesleyan's a big one.
Pratt & Whitney's in Middletown?
Yes.
Okay.
They build all the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter engines
and
in Middletown.
And how are their contracts going? Have they raised employment, lowered employment?
It fluctuates to some degree, but they are in the process of raising employment right now. They have $1 trillion in back orders from the U.S. government.
Wow.
And they're going to be looking to hire thousands of people across Connecticut in the coming decades.
Out of the Middletown plant, because it's also East Hartford.
A lot of them. I wouldn't say all of them, but a lot of them are going to be out of the Middletown plant.
They phased out North Haven, right, years ago. So why did they build up in Middletown?
The Middletown facility is a very high-level production facility. It's got some very significant testing equipment in there. And so when the engines are completed, they actually hook them up. There's a jet fuel line that runs under the ground at the plant. And they hook the jet engines in a special building to the jet fuel line, and they actually fire them up inside the plant and run a number of tests on them there. You can't really replicate that kind of testing facility very easily or without tremendous expense elsewhere. So that plant is very valuable to the company.
And that's more skilled work, I would take it, if it's a testing facility than if it's just assembly line.
Well, it's both. And all the workers there are very high skilled, I think. But it
How
does,
many jobs you got there?
Off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you, but there are a lot.
So automation, obviously, one factor in cutting factory work in Connecticut a half century ago was that factories are moving south and abroad and to suburbs because they wanted the horizontal land and cheaper, and also they wanted in the south to be away from labor unions. But the other, there have been defense buildup. We'll probably have one under President Trump as well. But automation is a countervailing factor, that we're building things with fewer people. Have you seen that at all with the Pratt & Whitney plant?
I haven't seen it at Pratt. We have seen it in some other facilities. There are some logistics facilities that have come into Middletown recently, and I've heard of some in other communities where they are automating some of their functions. But they still need people, and they still need skilled workers. And so these facilities do still provide quite a few jobs. Maybe not what it was 50 years ago or even 25 years ago, but there still is quite a bit of requirement for skilled employees there.
You're listening to the voice of Dan Drew, the mayor of Middletown, here on Dateline New Haven on WNHH Radio, your home for community radio. The reason we're talking to Dan Drew is because he's running for governor. And Dan, so who is Dan Drew and why is he interested in becoming the governor of our state? I should mention you're a Democrat.
I am a Democrat. I have an exploratory committee open to considering a run for governor right now.
And that's all a fiction so you could raise the money, right, but then not have to be bound by certain restrictions before it's official, correct?
Well, it's so that you can kind of test the waters, see what the voters are thinking, take the temperature of party activists. And
you can raise money?
You can raise money, yes.
So what's the difference when you announce?
Well, then the amounts that you can raise are different, and the ways that you can spend the money are different. So the statute that establishes the Citizens Election Program, which is the public financing system that we have in Connecticut, places different requirements on you depending on whether you're in an exploratory phase or whether you're in a candidate phase.
And when you're candidate phase, can you raise more and it's less when you're exploratory or vice versa?
When you're in exploratory, the maximum you can raise from any individual is $375. When you are in the candidate phase, the maximum you can raise from any individual is $100.
So why doesn't someone just say they're exploring until the day before the election because they then can raise more money and get it matched?
Because, well, first of all, that wouldn't really be consistent with the way the program works and the intent of the program. But you also, once you go beyond $100 in a contribution, that can't be counted towards your qualifying contributions. And you have to raise $250,000 in denominations of between $5 and $100 as the qualifying contributions.
Whichever you're in.
Yes, but if you raise more than $100 from somebody, then in the exploratory phase, then you have to resolicit them later or someone else to make up what you're going for in your qualifying funds. Otherwise, it doesn't count.
When you're in the election phase, so you're saying no matter which phase you're in, the most that can count toward getting to that $250,000 to get matching funds is $100.
Correct.
So you have to find, this mask is getting a little tricky. 250,000. You need to find 25,000 people to give you $100.
You need to find 2,500.
2,500. Oh, that's a good important zero there. Okay.
Yeah, to give you $100. But you know, like I said, the purpose of the exploratory phase is to allow you to raise the money that you need to move around the state and to communicate with people and to find out what's on their mind and to decide ultimately whether you want to take the plunge and make the full
run.
And
the way modern campaigns work, it does make sense that in early 2017 you had to get started, especially if you're not known statewide, if you wanted to be mounting a gubernatorial election for 2018. How are you finding it so far? Why did you decide that you wanted to run for governor?
I think one of the things that we've done in this country for a long time, in Connecticut too, but not just in Connecticut, I think across the entire country, is that we've gotten used to the idea, we take for granted that certain things are true. And there are certain notions that have become part of the wider political lexicon and our rhetorical assumptions. And we basically sort of default to the idea that trickle-down economics works, even if we don't use that terminology. And I think that's a big mistake.
You mean helping people have more wealth, keep more of their money with the thought that they would invest more of it and create jobs down. There's an article today in the New York Times op-ed page against Stephen Forbes and others urging Trump to embrace that with tax cuts for wealthy. They say that will instantly create jobs through new investment.
Correct. And it's never done that. And we've seen that theory fail time and time again. And I think the way that we become successful is to focus on the needs of the people in the middle. And we work to make sure that those people have better economic opportunities, that the regressive property tax burden on them is eased, and that they bear a lesser share of the income tax burden than the ultra wealthy do. And the problem is, I think, that in our society, we've gotten used to the idea that we have to kowtow to very elite people in order to make all of us successful. And what's ended up happening is it's a big, gigantic lie. And it means that we've put ourselves into the position where we've repeatedly asked the middle class and the working class to subsidize the wealthy on the presumption that it's good for them. And I just don't agree with that. I think it's wrong. I think it's immoral. I think it's bad public policy. And we've gotten too close to that kind of perspective. And I want to move away from it. I want to get back to the idea that we need to help real people. And that's how we become prosperous again as a society. And honestly, that'll be good for the wealthy as well, because then the economy will be better and everyone will be doing better.
So let's talk specifically. So I remember the arguments over the income tax when we started it in the early 90s under Governor Weicker. And then gradually over the years, we have made that tax more progressive. So I forget if it's $30,000 or $40,000 up to you making that amount a year, okay, you don't pay any taxes. And one argument given for the reason we've been running these huge budget deficits, I believe it's $1.7 billion for the coming years, that every year we are unable to accurately predict our revenues because the tax has gotten so progressive. So the theory goes, including under the theory of State Senator Martin Looney, who has pushed for those changes. He said, it's good we have a progressive income tax system, but because we rely so heavily on the outcomes of hedge fund managers and other financial industry people in Fairfield County, that their income is so uneven year to year how it's reported. And that for a bunch of years, because they've been reporting less income, our whole state economy has suffered huge hits. We have to make all these cuts and we have to swing our budgeting so much from year to year without good planning. So could the argument be made that in fact it's too progressive?
I don't think it could be made credibly for a couple of reasons. One is that it's much less progressive than a couple of our surrounding competitive states.
What are the numbers?
Off the top of my head, I don't remember.
Are you talking more like the carried interest and what you earned on investments as opposed to income?
The top marginal rate. The carried interest is a big issue also because it allows very, very wealthy people to hide, or at least to avoid paying taxes on a significant portion of their income. But there is room for movement where we could become more progressive.
One proposal was incomes over $1 million or over $500,000, get another 0.5% on the income tax.
Correct. And we'd still be under New York and New Jersey doing that. The other reason I don't think that it's a particularly compelling argument is because we haven't fixed any of the rest of how our government works at the state or the local level in particular. We are operating off of a very regressive local property tax structure. So the way I fund public schools and community policing and firefighters and all the things that I'm responsible for taking care of in Middletown is a regressive local property tax. And that's the only mechanism that we have that the state gives
us. Since 1994, when Bill Curry ran for governor again in 2002, and then when John DeStefano ran in 2006, the Democratic candidate in those years has argued that we have to change our reliance on the property tax, either have a statewide property tax that replaces the city one, or go more to the income tax for our revenue. Is that what you're proposing?
I think what you need to do is change some of what's driving the costs in the regressive property tax. So, for example, there are a lot of things that the state imposes on our school districts that make the operation of a school district vastly more expensive than it needs to be.
Be an example.
Well, we have something called a, what's it called? The minimum budget requirement. And so the minimum budget requirement means that we have to give the school district at least as much money as they had the year before. But the school boards also have total control over how that money is spent. and the cities and towns are the ones that have to actually raise the taxes to come up with the money. So what the state's done
is... states heavily finance local education. New Haven is more than half.
It's not nearly that much in our city or in most of the cities. But yes, I'm sure in New Haven it's pretty significant. Either way, what the state does is it gives the taxing authority to one body and gives control of the money to another body and guarantees that second body that it's never getting less than
it has. And it has to use property taxes to fund that. But you wouldn't be arguing spending less on schools, would you?
No, not at all. I have kids in the schools, and I don't think that we should be spending less on schools. But I think the problem with the system as it is currently structured is that it drives the use of consultants, outside contractors, and drives administrator salaries through the roofs. I've seen it in a lot of places. Where there are school administrators that make exorbitant salaries, they farm out a lot of their work.
And everybody is always upset about that. But then when you ask them what administrators to cut, you never get a good list. Can you name me three in Middletown?
Names?
Not people. Kind of jobs that get paid way too much for an administrator in Middletown.
Well, I think that you see very high salaries in your top-level administrators.
And that's because it's hard to get them because the market's so high, right?
I don't think that's the reason. I think that it's not... There are a lot of people out there who are certified as administrators. I think there's a closed market, and there is closed control. I think you have basically monopoly rents being paid to top-level school administrators across the state. By changing the structure. I think that you can give final control over the line items in a school board budget to a board of finance or a city council, or you can provide taxing authority directly to a board of education, where then you have greater control and greater accountability at the local level to the voters. The problem right now is that in towns and cities across the entire state, boards of education are responsible only for spending money without any responsibility for how
so
that money is acquired.
So you're saying that they could spend it better, especially with outside consultants and administrative.
Absolutely.
If you combine taxing authority, and then they'd have to run for office on the taxing.
Correct.
So outside consultants and administrative theory.
That's a piece of it. You know, we had, last year in Middletown, we had a company that was doing a lot of outside consulting work, and I had no ability to get rid of them. And my finance department did an analysis, and we believed that we were spending millions of dollars more on this consulting company.
What were they consulting on?
It was a contracting company. They were handling our custodial services management and our CAF services management. And I believe we were spending millions of dollars more than we should have been. And, you know, to their credit, ultimately the Board of Education let them go, but it ended up being a year and a half long battle to make it happen. And we spent way more money than we should have in the meantime. That money could have been better used on a variety of other things locally, and that would have freed up tremendous money in our budget to pay for
would you also switch the burden? How else would you get it? We got some questions sent in by a guy named Brian Chasby on our Facebook page. Before I get to that, Dan Drew, how would you otherwise shift the burden from what you're calling aggressive property tax system, which has been the rallying cry from cities? Would you also have more of an income tax to replace that stream? Would you raise the income tax?
Yeah, I'd raise the income tax on the very wealthy. I think closing the carried interest loophole would mm-hmm. be a very big, important step. And I think we really need to be very careful about the kind of money that we're spending on behalf of corporations, direct subsidies to corporations.
And I want to get to that. We're going to get the first five. But first, I'm going to remind people that they're listening to Dateline New Haven on WNHH Radio, your home for community radio, broadcast at 103.5 FM, live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. We're talking to Dan Drew. He's the third term, correct, mayor
yes.
of Middletown, four-year terms or two?
It's now four. I had 2 2-year terms, and now I'm in a four-year term.
And New Haven was talking about doing the same thing. And he's running for governor. Well, it's called exploratory, folks.
Exploring.
He's exploring a run for governor, which used to be an old-fashioned way of saying running for governor. Dan Drew, a guy named Brian Chasby, says the following. Wesleyans should pay taxes. Fire, police service, public works facilitating their graduations. Why doesn't Wesleyan pay taxes? Go, Dan, go. Jumped in Dave Flowers. But Brian continues. Income tax is supposed to fund pending pension deficits. Where'd the money go? Pension's still unfunded 25 years later because the politicians, I don't know if you call yourself the politicians or not, give their friends and family high-paying jobs. What do you have to say to Brian about that?
So, Brian, thank you for the question. There were multiple parts there, so I'll tackle them one by one. The reason Wesleyan doesn't pay, they do pay some taxes, and I think most universities do pay some. They're not exempt on everything. But the reason they don't pay is because they are exempt. Now, the state set up something called PILOT, Payment in Lieu of Taxes, and they're supposed to give us money
It's supposed to give us 70% of the value of the revenue that's lost. And we're currently, I believe, at between 30 and 40%, depending on if it's state-owned property.
Maybe.
And if it's just other kinds of hospitals
and
universities.
Yeah, and that money just hasn't been coming through in the last couple of years. And it's been degrading slowly. So you're absolutely right in that there is a problem because we send police up there. We send fire up there. And we work with them in a number of ways. So we don't receive any direct revenue for that. The taxpaying citizens of Middletown are essentially subsidizing the operations of the university in that regard. The university, I will say, has done a lot to work with us, and I appreciate all of their efforts. But there has to be some way for universities and cities to have a better financial connection, whether that comes through some form of taxation at some point, or better yet, a more equitable pilot structure for
cities. What about hospitals? You have Middlesex Hospital. We have Yale New Haven here. The governor has proposed that we can start taxing hospitals for their real estate, for their property, real estate property, and that they promised that Connecticut would make them whole through greater Medicaid reimbursements from the feds. What do you think about that?
Well, I'm not sure that this is a great idea. I'm not sure that the greater Medicaid reimbursements from the federal government will actually come through, particularly with the budget that President Trump has proposed. And even if that were the case, I have concerns about what it would do to the cost of healthcare in a city like Middletown or in any of the other cities around the state that have significant Medicaid populations. If there's money that we're not recovering right now through Medicaid that we should be, then we should go ahead and do that. But acquiring additional money out of the hospitals, I think, presents a number of potential danger zones that we have to be very mindful of.
And also, Brian had asked you about what happened with the pensions being funded. We had an income tax, and yet our pension fund deficits got so big. Any reasons for that?
Yeah. A lot of people for a long time just chose not to fund their liabilities. We fund our liabilities in Middletown that our actuaries tell us to fund every year, and sometimes it's inconvenient.
So the state hasn't done that. Wasn't there
balloon
payments,
too?
Well,
the state started doing that recently.
So what would you do now to fix the problem?
Well, there are a number of things, I think, that you look at. First of all, as I said, I think we have to back off on providing direct subsidies to corporations. That's a very dangerous zone to get into. That frees up some money that can help handle this problem. There's always the possibility of pension obligation bonds that, in and of itself, is something you have to be very careful.
So you'd borrow to pay off our debt?
Not necessarily, but I think it's not to pay off the debt. It's to refund your liabilities,
yeah.
So that you're funded at a reasonable percentage of
which
your liabilities.
Which then kicks the can down the road again. So in 20 years, the next person running for governor is going to say, how do we get here?
Not necessarily. It depends on how you structure it, and it depends on the assumptions that you use in the market to get returns on the pension. There are ways to,
refinance that and have it not be as big.
It's possible. It's a very complicated. You need to deal with financial advisors and bond counsel, so I don't want to proclaim
some of those
it.
Those great consultants
idea,
we're talking about. So now Rebecca Tercio has also written in a question on Facebook. Yeah, I am going to ask, how does he feel about legalizing, and I'm pretty sure she means legalizing marijuana. How do you feel about that? That's been put on the back burner, so to speak, in this term.
I am total supporter of it.
And what's the reason?
I think that the physical effects of marijuana are significantly lower than the physical effects of alcohol. I think that making marijuana illegal or keeping it illegal is a modern-day form of prohibition. Mm-hmm. And when we look back historically, we see how prohibition worked against alcohol. We know that a huge number of people smoke marijuana now. And they're going to do it regardless of whether it's illegal or not.
A lot of people use cocaine, too. Would you legalize cocaine?
No, because I think that it's very different. Its use is vastly more dangerous to people on an individual and societal level. And
whereas marijuana is not any evidence that it really harms society.
Correct. And I think that...
Though it can get rid of your ambition a little bit.
Yeah, but...
Now, I haven't smoked pot for like 30 years. I heard it's a lot stronger now.
You know, I actually don't know. Nobody ever believes me when I say this, but I've never tried it.
Okay. Because I'm told it's a lot stronger, like infinitely more powerful than it used to be.
I really don't know. I really don't know the answer.
Yeah. Is that because you knew you'd run for office? Is that why?
No, I was never interested in it. I don't like the feeling of not being in control of my body or my faculties. So, I'm not a big...
don't do bungee jumping?
Never been bungee jumping. unless you count that ripcord thing you do at Six Flags. I did that
once.
Oh,
yeah? What was that like?
was pretty wild.
And you weren't in control of your body, were you?
No, but I was in control of my brain.
That's a good point.
That's the bigger thing.
That's the bigger thing. Yeah, it is. Okay, so Dan Drew, you're running for governor. Now, what made you want to run? 37 years old, you're young.
Yeah, I think that these problems need to be fixed. I think we are moving in the wrong direction when it comes to our attitude about how we handle the economy. And if we don't turn it around, then it's going to have a negative effect for another generation. There's been an entire generation, you know, basically for my entire life, we've been moving further and further in this direction where we sort of concede the idea that we have to do everything we can to help the most elite among us. And I think that's the wrong attitude.
Were you a Bernie guy in the primaries?
No, I actually supported Hillary in the primaries.
Wait a second. But, you're sounding a lot more like Bernie Sanders than Hillary Clinton. She gave the speeches to Goldman Sachs. She was for the trade deal. She said it wasn't simple. We're not Denmark, Bernie. I think she said that at one debate about whether we can have universal health care.
There's a lot I like about both of them. I think Bernie is a wonderful, wonderful public servant. I think he's got great ideas. I thought Hillary had a lot of great ideas, and you know, it came down where it came down. But they're both great public servants. And
Howard Dean, the former presidential candidate for 2004 and Democrat national chairman, he was at Yale a few months ago, and he said he thinks the biggest problem for the Democratic Party, in order to embrace the kind of issues you're talking about and to get a younger generation, she said the baby boomers have to step aside. He said we need younger. He was for Mayor Pete, whose last name I can't pronounce.
Buttigieg. I know him.
Oh, you know, were you for him for the Democratic
Party? Yeah, I know. We belong to a group together. I've known him for a couple of years.
What's the group?
It's called the New Deal.
What is that group?
It's a group of pro-growth, progressive, Democratic elected officials at the state and local level from around the country.
Where is he? South Bend, Indiana?
South Bend, yeah.
And so do you put yourself in that mold?
In what mold specifically?
It's younger, pro-progressive, economic policy, Democrats.
Yeah, I believe in a progressive economic policy. I believe in ideas very similar to Franklin Roosevelt's. And, you know,
I'm trying to figure out why he supported Hillary Clinton.
Because
she was a corporate Democrat, trickle-down economics, more than Trump was on the stage.
Well, I don't know if she was. No, I don't think more than Trump. I don't think she was a big believer in trickle-down economics. You know, I think one of her problems is that she vacillated on some of her message at some point during
Let me bring
campaign.
You back to Dean. So
sure.
Dean said the reason Mayor Pete needed to be the chairman is that we need people in their 60s and 70s to step aside and let younger people take over, because he said that millennials have voted in the greatest numbers for Democrats, but they're the smallest numbers belonging to the party they feel is not theirs. I'm giving you a softball here, Mayor Drew. You're 37 years old. What's Mayor Pete, like 37 as well?
He's 35, I think.
Okay, so you're even
35 or 36.
Do you see part of your campaign as a generational pitch? The other people named are Nancy Wyman, Marty Looney, people who are 68, 70 years old. Mayor Harps talked about it. Mayor Ganim might be in his 60s, but you got to add a few years for serving time in jail. What are you making this pitch about age? Are you a generational candidate?
You know, I want to be a transformational candidate. I don't want to make my pitch based on my age. I want to make my pitch based on ideas. And I think that we need to shift. The baby boom generation largely has embraced this idea of trickle-down economics over time. And I think we need to move back in the other direction. It's not working for us. So for me, I'm not saying that I'm a young candidate and I should be selected because I'm a young candidate. I do bring energy to the table. And I think, you know, as a young father and a husband, I know what it's like to raise a family and to struggle. There have been times over the years, and not that long ago, when my wife and I had some really difficult times financially, or where we had trouble finding a job or paying for healthcare. I understand what that's like in this day and age. And that's the kind of thing that I want to fix for everybody. Because
you spoke about
at all
being a parent.
Are,
how many kids do you have?
I have four.
How old? Wow. You're busy. How old?
I have a 12-year-old, a 10-year-old, a 7-year-old, and a 16-month-old.
Whoa. And you getting any sleep?
No.
You look pretty rested to me.
I do okay. You know, I can function on very little sleep, so I'm in good shape.
So we're getting a lot of comments here on our Facebook page. One is about this issue about you being a parent. Mm-hmm. Mr. Mayor, one area where the governor was successful was advancing early childhood education in Connecticut. As a father of young children, what are your ideas for making Connecticut the model for ECE, early childhood education, to the rest of the country?
Well, I think the state's got to commit to funding early childhood education and early care. That's something that actually has been reduced sharply in the last budget. There's a huge imperative to that. So first of all, we have to provide early care and education, because it gets kids off on the right foot and it enables them to start kindergarten in the right position. And if they don't have that when they start kindergarten, then they're behind right from the get-go. And that's a problem. The other problem is that early care and education is a huge economic issue, because if childcare isn't available for parents who need it, particularly parents at the lower end of the income rung or in the middle, then they're not going to be able to work, or they're going to have tremendous childcare expenses out of pocket that is going to inhibit their ability to contribute to the economy. So early care and education is a moral issue, and it's a huge economic issue, and it's something that we have to commit to.
And we have to remind people that you listen to Dateline New Haven on WNHH Radio, New Haven's home for community radio. We have Dan Drew, the mayor of Middletown, the first serious candidate out of the box for governor of Connecticut. He has exploratory committee. He's running as a Democrat. He's calling himself a New Deal Democrat. Mayor Drew, I just have to be a little honest with you. You're getting a lot more response than we've had normally on our shows here. The mayor of New Haven is on every Monday. We don't get this kind of response from people writing in, because most of our shows are listened to later. You will be this show. If you're listening live, you're listening Wednesday morning. But in fact, we play these repeatedly on the internet and on podcasts. But a few people writing in. James Bundari Alexander says, New Deal Group is more of a DLC-style thing, not left-leaning. That means the Democratic Leadership Council, which was set up to have big corporations feel more comfortable with the Democratic Party. You cop guilty, innocent to that charge?
There are some connections there with the DLC, but I think the group is made up largely of progressive elected officials from around the country that want to see a progressive economic policy.
Progressive is a fungible term. You've been defining it as not giving as much public assistance to corporations create jobs, and we will get back to that because I want to ask you about First Five. But are you a DLC, a very much a DLC position, was the dawn of industrial policy, where government and neoliberalism, where government did say we're going to help companies make money and that'll create jobs for others, which is a form of trickle down, democratic form. That's not where you're going.
No, that's not where I'm going, and I don't think that's where all the members of the group are either. I think there's a recognition. When I used the term earlier, pro-growth progressive, my interpretation of that term, and I guess you could argue that it is a fungible term, is essentially that we have to be mindful of the fact that there needs to be a robust private sector. There's a right way and a wrong way to go about doing that. And that's where the difference comes in for me.
All right. And Brian writes in, if you're so progressive, why don't you support Bernie? We talked about that. Clinton is the epitome of corporatist. What about single-payer health care and tuition-free university? Like New York just passed. I think they passed in New York. Did they just propose it?
I support both.
Yeah. So you do support single-payer health care. Would you do that in Connecticut?
Yes.
You would do? How would you do that?
Well, you have to work with the General Assembly and the hospitals. But I think setting up a single-payer health care system at the state level would drive health care costs down. And that's one of the things
that
never...
And would that be because not profits for insurance companies, or because you'd have everyone in the pool?
You'd have everybody in the pool.
And this is the insurance state, so Aetna would basically burn you an effigy, but they've kind of left the state to a large extent, haven't they?
Well, I don't know that they would burn anyone an effigy. I think that...
I mean, worst things can happen as long as it's effigy.
I guess. As long as they don't burn me for real, I guess we're in good shape. Listen, at the end of the day, a lot of companies make money by reducing competition and by ensuring that they control a segment of the market so that they can charge monopoly rents. And I'm not talking about any specific company, but that's just the reality of the corporate world.
I don't understand why we need private insurance companies. Basically, we have experiences like this every day at the Independent, where they try to find every way not to give you insurance when you need it, but they want to charge you as much as possible.
Correct. It's one of the only services that I can think of that you pay out the nose for, and then the minute you need to use it, you're penalized for using it.
Right.
That's just, I mean, you know, the problem that I'm trying to describe here is that our economy, you know, we have people who say this is a free market, right? They love that term because it sounds great, and who can argue with a term like that? But we have a new form of serfdom, and that's the problem that we're living with in this society right now, because it's cast as a free market, but we're really subjugated in an awful lot of ways. And if we had a single-payer healthcare system...
How would you pay for it? You said it'd be cheap overall, which I have that same religion. I don't know, economists agree and disagree depending where they stand. But how do you pay for it? There are different kinds of models of how you pay for a single-payer healthcare.
Well, I think, first of all, the big thing that never gets talked about in healthcare, we talk about how to pay for things, we talk about how to structure insurance. The thing nobody ever talks about is actually driving down costs. And one of the things that Medicare is so good at, and as you all know, Medicare is a single-payer system, is controlling costs. And controlling costs in the healthcare system is very, very important. So part of the way it's done is that you have your costs significantly reduced. And again, getting back to paying for things, you close the carried interest loophole, you raise the top marginal tax rate, you eliminate direct corporate subsidies in many instances, and you remove a lot of the restrictions that drive the cost of doing business. And there are a lot of them. There are a lot of antiquated ways that we do business that weren't evil or malevolent. They were introduced in, you know,
give 40, me the top two.
Well, right now, the requirements on local municipalities to pay for special education and a number of the costs in terms of special education are particularly onerous. Now, we have a huge responsibility and a moral obligation to take care of special education costs. But I think it might make sense for the state to look at picking that up for municipalities. Mm-hmm. And that will enable municipalities to free up a lot of the money in their own
budget.
But
a state, who would administer a single-payer system? Would we contract out to an insurance company, or would we have the state bureaucracy run it?
I don't know yet. That'd be something to discuss with experts. I couldn't give you a real answer on that today.
But in terms of paying for it, you say you partly pay for it by controlling costs the way Medicare does. You partly pay for it by raising more money through a top marginal tax rate increase and fewer corporate subsidies. Any other thoughts on how you'd pay for this tuition-free college is also expensive and single payer.
Well, one of the ways I think you can do tuition-free college is you expand the availability of degree programs at community colleges. That's a big one. And that's something that we can commit to and invest in. And we have to, really, to stay competitive, particularly with other states around us doing it.
All right. By the way, Rebecca wrote back in about marijuana. She said, with the stronger marijuana, what you do now is you smoke less of it.
Got it. Okay.
But I seem to remember.
If I ever try it, I'll take her advice. Next time I go to Massachusetts.
You're listening to Dateline New Haven on WNHH Radio. Our guest today is Dan Drew, Mayor of Middletown. He's running for governor. Okay, let's get the first five. Been holding you back. You've been wanting to talk about this the whole hour. Corporate subsidies. So the Malloy administration has had a plan where they pick big employers who claim they're either going to leave the state or they're thinking of leaving the state or they want to expand here. And he gives them big subsidies because they said otherwise we'd lose all the tax revenue to create jobs. We had an example here in New Haven with Alexion Pharmaceuticals, the biggest new employer in town, has a 13-story skyscraper that they call 14 stories because they're superstitious about that 13th floor. And they created more jobs than they even said they would. On the other hand, they currently have a scandal with how they promote and sell their product, which has driven down their sales price and gives them jitters about their future. We had a support for a hedge fund that they said was going to leave the state. Now, obviously, part of this discussion goes back many years. We worried that states play against each other for a race to the bottom, that they each offer so many benefits to a company to stay where they are or move. The company just has to pretend they're going to move, and they get so much tax benefit that in the end, the government doesn't benefit. The people don't benefit because the whole reason you want them here is jobs and taxes, and then you end up paying them for it. But what about when you're operating in the real world and you do have to compete against other states? Is Malloy wrong? Should we not have given millions of dollars of tax breaks to Alexion Pharmaceuticals?
One of the big problems when we discuss this type of approach to economic development is it's predicated on the assumption that taxes are the only thing that matter to a corporation. And
that wasn't the case with GE. They wanted to be in the high-tech environment.
I don't think that was the case with GE at all. I think that was a smokescreen with GE. And taxes matter. I mean, I'm not saying they don't matter. And I'm not saying that, you know, a tax abatement or some type of incentive is inappropriate. We use them in Middletown. Mm-hmm. But you have to use them in a way that I think ultimately makes sense. And the litmus test for me is whether an incentive does one of two things, whether it creates more meaningful jobs for the people in that you're responsible for taking care of in your community or in your state, or if it generates a significant amount of tax revenue that you can use to handle your other responsibilities. So let me give you an example. Recently, FedEx Ground decided to locate a Northeast Regional Distribution Center in Middletown. Massive facility. It's nearly $250 million investment. And the thing that mattered more to them than, and they did get a tax abatement from us and the state combined.
And is that a phase in when your tax bill won't go to its total amount right away? We'll phase
Correct.
It in for 5 years.
Correct.
That always made the most sense to me of all tax breaks because you don't have that money already and they do theoretically pay it soon.
Correct. And you're not spending anything that you don't already have. It's, right. it's a little bit of a loss. I don't even want to call it a loss leader, but you're taking a little bit less on the front end than you might otherwise to incentivize them.
But you're arguing that that isn't usually the big determining factor, and you're about to tell
Correct.
Me why that was true with FedEx Ground in Middletown.
Correct. So let me give you a little backstory, and I'll try to get through this fast. In 2012, Governor John Hickenlooper of Colorado came to Middletown. He was one of the founders of the Community Health Center, and they had their 40th anniversary. I had dinner with him a couple nights in a row at their celebrations. And he told me a story about when he was mayor of Denver and Boeing was relocating from Seattle, ultimately to Chicago. Denver was one of the cities they were looking at. And Denver and the state of Colorado tossed a huge amount of money at Boeing, and they ended up choosing not to go there. They went to Chicago instead, and Chicago offered significantly less money. And so Governor Hickenlooper, who was then the mayor of Denver, called them. He called his contact at Boeing, and he said, "Why did you go to Chicago? I offered you all of this, and it was so much more." And they chuckled a little and said, "Mayor, we have a company with a $50 billion market capitalization. Your money's nice, but it doesn't mean that much to us. To us, the real money is tied up in our ability to get going on schedule, to get our new building up and running so we can launch, I think it was the Dreamliner, the 787 that they were looking at doing at the time." And what Chicago did was they put, and this is one of the things they did, was they put building inspectors in the lobby of the building where Boeing's engineers were. So when Boeing's engineers had to change order or they had to shift around how the building was going to work, rather than having to go down to Chicago City Hall and take all these months and all this extra time and money to go and wait in line, they literally got in an elevator and went downstairs.
Streamline regulatory approval. Big so time. Would you have done the Alexion package for New Haven?
Well, I don't know enough about the Alexion package to say one way or the other, but I can tell you with our FedEx deal, one of the things that we did was we promised them a 3-month turnaround. We were able to turn them around within 3 months, and that involved multiple regulatory bodies in Middletown and Cromwell. Mm-hmm. And we devoted building inspectors to their project.
Oh, you got the idea from...
I did. I stole the idea, and it worked. And that's how we've approached economic development ever
since.
So
what would you have said no to? Would you have said no to the $22 million package of grants and loans to keep the headquarters of Bridgewater Associates head funds?
Absolutely not.
You would not have said no?
I would have said no.
Okay. What about the argument that that's one reason our income tax receipts are so variables, because we can't count on that kind of income? You're driving away the golden goose.
Well, I don't think that we should be extorted by some of the richest people in the world. That doesn't make sense to me either.
But what if the option is that in the unfortunate reality of how the world works with the race to the bottom among the states, if we don't get extorted, we're not going to have any jobs or income tax revenues?
Well, I think we're not going to know that unless it happens at some point. And if we agree to start borrowing public money that the middle class is going to have to pay back to give to some of the wealthiest people in the world, then what we're doing is setting up an incentive structure that tells all the other rich people in the world that they can come and threaten to leave and that they'll get, you know, tens of millions of dollars from the taxpayers of the state of Connecticut. I don't think that's the right way to do it. It doesn't make any sense to me. And, you know, if you've got somebody who is literally worth billions of dollars running a company worth billions and billions and billions of dollars, hundreds of billions, then how can we justify borrowing money that you and I and everyone else is going to have to pay back to take care of that while we're simultaneously cutting money for public schools?
Dan Drew, candidate for governor in Connecticut. Sanctuary cities. Is Middletown a sanctuary city?
Yes, although I don't like that term.
Why?
Because it's pejorative and it implies that we're hiding people, and that's not the case. What we're doing is telling the federal government that they don't have a right to commandeer our police department, that we believe in the 10th Amendment to the Constitution, that it's not our responsibility to conduct federal immigration enforcement, which is the job of the federal government.
How much money are they going to take away from you?
None. I think it's a bogus lie. I think it's a threat. I think this president is all talk and all bluster. He doesn't have the ability or the guts to actually do it.
Bus service just gets worse and worse in our city. It's a transportation option of last resort, not of choice. What can you do to improve bus service in Connecticut?
Well, I think we need a broad transportation infrastructure improvement.
Do you agree with the governor's plan, billions of dollars?
Yeah, I think the governor's on the right track when it comes to transportation infrastructure.
Bus service has gotten really worse in the last 6 years in New Haven. Is that the right track?
I'm not sure. I don't know anything about New Haven's transport. I used to use the bus, actually, to get to work every day myself.
I try. It's almost impossible. I walk miles instead. It's quicker, even in a storm.
Really? I used to use the local bus in Middletown to get from my house downtown, and then I'd get on a Hartford Transit bus, and I had a choice of either an express bus or
Hartford,
the
longer
bus.
It works great to Hartford, in and out of Hartford.
I remember a couple times. I used to actually work in Bridgeport, and I couldn't find reasonable connecting buses to get me from Middletown down to Bridgeport. So an investment in transportation infrastructure and our bus network and in mass transit in general, I think, is very important. You know, we talk about expanding the highways, widening the highways. Economists always talk about induced demand when we do that. All you do is invite more cars and trucks. I think mass transit is a very wise investment to make.
So, Dan Drew, how'd you get in politics? You grew up in Middletown?
I grew up in New Milford, actually. New York and the Hudson Valley, and then in New Milford, Connecticut.
That's
just
nice
north of Danbury.
There. What brought you to Middletown?
My wife and I just decided to settle there. After college for a few years, we lived outside Washington, D.C. She was a teacher down there, and then we wanted to move home to settle down, and we just picked Middletown.
Middletown?
Yeah, we picked it.
Over New Haven.
It was a great place. It was central for us. We loved it. It was, you know, we found an affordable place, and It was just a great place for us to settle down. She was pregnant with our oldest at the time, and we were just very comfortable with it.
So you were an EMT at 18 years old.
I was in New Milford, yeah, for New Milford Ambulance.
And then at 23, after graduating from UConn, you were a journalist to expose political corruption. Tell me about that.
So I was doing a story on the Prince William County Sheriff's race had gotten very hot, and that sounds kind
of
silly here,
right? Outside
Virginia,
DC, outside
it's in Northern Virginia, outside DC.
And whom were you working for?
The Potomac News and Manassas Journal Messenger, which were part of the Media General Corporation, which all of us reporters.
Don Singleton.
God, that name sounds very familiar.
Yeah.
Dean Singleton. No, Dean Singleton was a different paper. Singleton was out of Colorado.
Yeah.
Media General was a different company. The Connecticut Post, when I worked there, was owned by Singleton. But
okay.
We used to pejoratively refer to Media General as Media Generous.
So you decided to be a reporter first. And why? That was your first goal, career goal?
Well, not really. I kind of fell into it. So when I was at UConn, I ran the Daily Campus there, the student newspaper, and it was something that I enjoyed. And I've always loved writing, and I enjoyed the process of reporting. And right after I graduated, I was trying to figure out what to do. And the only thing I had any practical experience in was journalism. And I ended up getting the job at the two dailies outside Washington, D.C. And while I was there, I was doing a story, a roundup on the campaign finance reports of a number of public officials. And one of them was E. Lee Stoffregan III, who was the party boss and county sheriff in Prince William County, Virginia. He's a Democrat and very powerful, very, very strong fundraiser. And I noticed that there was a listed on his report was a payment from a company called Van Kampen Investments out of Kansas City, Missouri. And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, why is a company out of Kansas City making a direct contribution to a sheriff in a Virginia local sheriff's race? And so I called him up and he said, that company is owned by a local guy and their office is there in Kansas City. And he made a donation through the company to my campaign. And so I said, okay. And I wrote down what he said. And I got a tip the next day from somebody that Van Kampen was not owned by any kind of local person, but was in fact a subsidiary of Morgan Stanley. So I started looking into it more and more, and I ended up calling the company, and they were in fact a subsidiary of Morgan Stanley, owned by a variety of shareholders around the world. The company ended up conducting an audit for me. They couldn't find any. It was against their policy to donate. They didn't have any contributions directly made to him, and he wouldn't give me a copy of the check. And we ended up figuring out that it was a check written by a local person out of a money market account, but we had caught their campaign in misrepresenting where some of these checks were coming from. And then we ended up finding a couple of more, and I did a series.
And why were they misrepresenting those checks?
To this day, I don't know the exact reason. What ended up happening as a result of the whole thing was a special prosecutor was appointed, and they ended up conducting an investigation and indicted him on separate charges that came about as a result of the investigation the special prosecutor did. So he was not indicted for...
So if they did that story, you'd want to go in politics yourself and have people like the young Dan Drew look at your finances, or do you feel like there aren't reporters like that around here?
I'm not worried about what goes into my report.
What's the first thing you would ask Dan Drew running for governor?
Why do you want to do it?
All right, we got to that.
Yeah.
So then you went to the Connecticut Post, and what'd you cover there?
I covered Stratford, Monroe, and Easton.
Yeah, and why did you make the shift away from newspapering to go to politics?
Well, for me, I like the ability to get hands-on and get into something and make changes directly. And that's one of the most exciting things about serving in public life. You have the ability to reach out and touch somebody in a way that very often is not headline-worthy. Some of the most exciting parts of what I get to do as mayor are things that would never make the papers, but I know that they make a huge difference in a person's life, and that really means something. And it's those moments when you can see that you made a difference to an individual or to a community that are the most satisfying, and that really means something to me.
And you worked as a young father. You went from journalism to the community renewal team,
mm-hmm.
where you developed a welfare to work program for single mothers. Tell
yes.
me about that.
So that was a program in Middletown. We did it in conjunction with the Chamber of Commerce and Middlesex Community College. And it was funded by a state grant that was designed to take people from TANF, Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, into the workforce. So what we ended up doing was designing a program with originally three, but ultimately two employment tracks, one in healthcare and one in retail. And almost everybody flocked to, in fact, I think everybody flocked to the healthcare track. So we did some remedial coursework with them at Middlesex Community College, got them trained as CNAs, certified nurses assistants, and then got them on the job training through the chamber. And by the time everybody graduated, they had job offers and they were all working and had the ability to move on to become LPNs and eventually RNs if they wanted to.
Running your campaign is Kyle Buda.
Kyle's working with me, yep.
Is he campaign manager?
Yeah, Kyle's campaign coordinator. Yeah.
How old is he?
Oh, he's in his late 20s right now, I think.
He ran the campaign of Justin Ellicker for mayor of New Haven in 2013. Why did you pick Kyle, and what does that say about the generational aspect of your campaign that you've been dodging me on?
Well, Kyle works with the Vinci Group, which is a political consulting and management firm that I've been working with for a long time. They've run my mayoral races, and Kyle's a really smart guy, and I trust him.
Aren't they a subsidiary of Van Campen?
No. No, not that I know of, but if I find out, I will let you know and you can report on it.
Finally, Dan June, what a pleasure it's been to meet you and hear about your campaign. When a governor or a mayor gets elected, usually they're going to have something unexpected happen in their term that you're going to have to deal with, whether it was climate change and these big storms that Malloy got, or if there's a scandal agency. But usually an elected official tries to pick one big accomplishment per term, and that's a lot. And I remember watching mayors over the year in New Haven might be, we're going to fix the housing authority this term, or we're going to get a whole neighborhood agency going and get rid of blight. Do you have one big accomplishment that you would like to see as governor that would be your legacy?
I want to create a better economy for people.
All right. Well, you've taken the first steps running for governor. Dan June, thanks so much for coming on to Dateline New Haven today on WNHH Radio.
Thanks for having me.
I think obviously from the response, our listeners loved getting an introduction to you, and I hope you come back.
I'd love to.
And we're going to take it out. Thanks to Yale New Haven Hospital for providing support for today's program. We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew How It Feel to Be Free from the group CD, A Plea for Peace. Now, we know what it's like to be free. We just got to remember to book our flight. Book your flight with us all day and all night long here at WNHH, New Haven's home for community radio.